Good morning. The first case on our docket is 09-SC-1050, Air Wisconsin Airlines versus William Hoper. Are both parties ready? Thank you. Just to refresh everybody's recollection, argument is for 30 minutes. You'll have to keep track of your own time. And please state your name as you begin your argument. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is David Yoon. I represent the petitioner, Air Wisconsin Corporation. I would like to reserve approximately 5 to 10 minutes for a rebuttal. This appeal arises out of a large defamation award based on an airline's report of suspicious behavior to TSA pursuant to federal law. It involves an important and timely question of whether such a report, which resulted in William Hoper being removed from his flight, briefly detained and questioned, and placed on a later flight, justifies an award, a defamation award of $1.4 million. And I'd like to briefly go over the facts a little bit to place in context what happened.
Maybe for the benefit of the audience, you can explain a little bit about what defamation is.
Sure. Defamation is speech that is uttered to a third party where the other party was, I'm sorry, I didn't prepare for the definition.
I think you can handle it.
Sure. Defamation is a claim where a party says that a story or speech about that person is false and defamatory and hurts their reputation.
Thank you.
Okay, on December 8th, 2004, William Hoper, an airline pilot, was in Virginia for flight simulator training that was necessary for his continued employment. Hoper had failed 3 prior proficiency tests and was under a last chance agreement. Mr. Hoper was also a FFDO, or a federal flight deck officer, who was authorized to carry a firearm onto an aircraft. During this training session, Mr. Hoper became very angry. He yelled profanities toward his instructors and walked out in the middle of the session. Based on his behavior and his training failure, his termination was imminent. And before Mr. Hoper's flight left Dulles Airport for Denver, Air Wisconsin became concerned. When Mr. Hoper's outburst was initially reported, Air Wisconsin was dealing with a personnel matter. However, when Air Wisconsin later discovered or realized that Mr. Hoper was an FFDO, they became concerned about the whereabouts of his firearm and a possible airline safety issue, as required by federal law and as required by TSA policy. Air Wisconsin called TSA to report its concerns and suspicions. And following this call, TSA, in conducting their own investigation, decided to remove Mr. Hoper from the flight, question and search him, and then allowed him to board a later flight.
Well, Mr. Yoon, what was suspicious about the behavior of Mr. Hoper?
There were a few things. Mr. Hoper, on December 8th, got an angry outburst. He used profanities toward his instructor, and he walked out in the middle of a session. And as a result, he was also, before I mentioned that, he was also under a last chance agreement. Had he failed this proficiency check, he was going to be terminated. And he walked out in the middle of the training session. His termination was imminent. So we had a person who was facing termination and who displayed angry outbursts. And then Air Wisconsin later learned that he may possibly have a firearm. And that caused alarm, and under the statute that was enacted following 9/11, Air Wisconsin became concerned and reported this incident. And reported not, as the Court of Appeals said, a threat, but reported a suspicion of a threat.
They also said that they thought he was mentally unstable. Is that not correct?
Yes.
And go ahead, sir.
They reported that we were concerned about his mental stability.
And that he was authorized to carry a gun.
Yes, that he was an FFDO who may be armed, and we are concerned about the whereabouts of his firearm. And
you also reported that he was fired or terminated.
Terminated.
Right, today.
Yeah, the word was terminated today. And
you said he was unstable, and that's why it was terminated, right?
I don't think it expressed why he was terminated.
Unstable pilot in FDO program was terminated today.
Yes, that was one of the statements that the jury found to be defamatory. So those were the gist or all of the statements that were uttered. And I want to first talk about the context of those statements by discussing the federal statute. In the aftermath of 9/11, Congress passed the Aviation and Transportation Security Act by federalizing aviation security and forming a new agency called TSA to spearhead these security measures. Airlines were no longer responsible for making threat assessments concerning passenger or airline safety. Instead, the act required TSA to do those tasks. Airlines instead were required to simply disclose suspicious transactions so that TSA can conduct its own investigation and make its own threat assessment. And toward that end, the act provided a qualified immunity for air carriers and employees who make a voluntary disclosure of suspicious transactions. And the purpose of this act was to encourage airlines and employees to report suspicions. And TSA could civilly fine airlines for not reporting suspicious transactions. And furthermore, TSA also had a policy right before this incident took place called When in Doubt, Report. And this policy, again, was designed to change the pre-9/11 mindset, and the policy required airlines to report suspicions without conducting an investigation and providing the information so that TSA can conduct its own investigation. And it's in that context that the court should evaluate the statement in question.
Well, that might be fine if it were an isolated incident, but I guess the proof is that was before the jury that there was a long lead-up by a person who particularly had it in for this person, and it was set up for him to fail in the simulator, and why wouldn't a person be angry? And does the federal statute exempt somebody who makes a false claim knowing that basically it's being done for retaliatory purpose?
Well, the federal statute does not exempt a airline from reporting false information with actual knowledge that it was false or acting with reckless disregard for the truth.
Well,
or falsity.
Wasn't that the evidence before the jury, that the jury could find that in fact it was false and in fact made with malice?
I would submit that if the court does a de novo review of the record, that it does not support that finding. And I could go through the statement and explain why.
Well, Mr. Young, one thing I'd like to understand is that whole situation about Mr. Doyle, is that, that was the reporter's name?
Yeah, Mr. Doyle is the person who made the report.
Sure. So he evidently had dinner with Mr. Hopper. Is that how you say his name?
The dinner was on a different, about 2 months before.
2 months earlier. It wasn't at that same time?
Yes, there was some testimony about that.
Is that, did bad blood arise between them at that point, or? I'm just unclear from the record exactly what happened.
I would submit to you that the bad blood did not exist between Mr. Doyle and Mr. Hopper. What they're talking about are Mr. Christensen, who was not involved in the report at all, was the main person that they disliked, Mr. Hopper and Mr. Christensen. And he was, I think, done with his training like 8 months before this incident. And Mr. Doyle was the one who said, I want a fresh look and have a different instructor review Mr. Hopper.
Mr. Yoon, I maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that after this incident that was reported, that Mr. Doyle changed his notes about the day or the time in October, I think it was, to reflect that this is the time he actually had dinner with Mr. Hopper, say that he was afraid of his own physical harm as a result of whatever happened in October. Is that wrong?
Yes, there was testimony and evidence regarding a prior training session unrelated to December 8th.
Right, and that was the time that he had dinner, didn't he?
There was testimony about that, and Mr. I think Doyle retracted that testimony. And so there was dispute about whether that actually occurred or not.
Mr. Yoon, you asked us to consider the facts in the context of the reporting requirement.
Yes.
The reporting requirement, as you stated, is somewhat broader than the qualified immunity when considered with the exception to qualified immunity. Wouldn't you agree that we have to consider the facts in the context of the qualified immunity, which makes it very clear that there's a line to be drawn there, and it's not as extensive as report any suspicious behavior, regardless of what that suspicion is based upon?
If I'm trying to understand your question, I believe that you do have to consider the context. There's two different things. There's a statute which provides a qualified immunity, and there's also, because this is a defamation case, the issue of whether or not, number one, the statements are a statement of suspicion or opinion and not actionable, and two, whether there's independent review, based on independent review, whether there's clear and convincing evidence of actual malice. So there's two different issues. And I would submit if the court just focuses on the First Amendment principles, whether or not, based on a de novo review, whether there's clear and convincing evidence of actual malice, it will conclude, as we have, that there is not. And I think that will resolve, actually, the qualified immunity issue. If you find that there is no evidence, clear and convincing evidence of actual malice based on de novo review, then I think the issue of qualified immunity will follow.
But obviously the jury thought otherwise, because it did find that. And so that brings us to the issue of qualified immunity. And if these statements were to be absolutely immune, we wouldn't be calling it qualified immunity. There's some qualifications there.
Yes. But that's what I'm trying to get at is.
And if you would, please, yes.
As I understand the defamation law, that this court has to do an independent review of the record to determine whether or not there's evidence or clear and convincing evidence of actual malice. If the court, whatever conclusion the court reaches on that point, will necessarily resolve the immunity issue.
Let me put it this way to you then. The jury thought that there was malice, and the Court of Appeals thought that there was malice. So what's your best argument to convince us that both of them were wrong?
Sure. Number one is that the court has to do an independent review. And I would submit to you, the court needs to keep several constitutional principles in mind and when in conducting that independent review. One, failure to investigate is not sufficient to find actual malice unless it amounts to purposeful avoidance of the truth. Two, impeachment of speaker's credibility is not an affirmative evidence of actual malice, as stated in the Bose Corp United States case. Spite, number three, spite, hatred, intent to harm does not establish actual malice, absent an intent to harm through false statements. Four, actual malice is determined at the time of the publication and not based on post-publication evidence. Five, actual malice affords a safe harbor for a rational interpretation of events that do not speak for themselves. So when the court examines what occurred on December 8th and the statements in question and the circumstances under which they were made, I would submit to you that Doyle's report, Mr. Doyle's report, was a rational interpretation of what was an ambiguous event. And I could go through these statements. First, Doyle said, we were concerned about Mr. Hopper's mental stability. This statement is supported by the following undisputed facts. Before December 8th training session, Hopper failed three proficiency checks and had angry outbursts where he deflected responsibility for the training failures. Two, Hopper signed a last chance agreement placing his employment in jeopardy. Three, on December 8th, 2004, Hopper was in his final and fourth proficiency check under this last chance agreement. During this proficiency check, Hopper became angry, slid his seat back quickly, raised his voice, and used profanities toward his instructor. He walked out in the middle of this training session. Hopper admits in his answer brief, he shouted the following, this is a bunch of shit. Told his Sherman that he was railroading the situation and it's not realistic. And you win, I'm calling Alpha Legal. Several witnesses testified that they had never seen or heard a professional pilot acting like Hopper on December 8th. And after Hopper walked out of his last training session, his termination was imminent. He testified that he knew his termination was imminent and expected to receive notice of his termination. And based on those undisputed facts that occurred on December 8th, it was rational to be concerned about his mental stability.
And yet, is there not evidence in the record, as I read in opposing counsel's briefing, that the other Air Wisconsin executives had no such concerns?
Yes.
None of them relayed any concerns, and when they testified, they didn't have any concerns about his mental instability.
There were testimony after the fact testified whether, did you feel that, there were questions about whether did you feel that he was a threat, and they said that they did not. And I would submit to you, as we pointed out in our answer brief, that they did not have a lot of other facts. Number one, they did not know about whether or not he was an FFDO. Whether a pilot is an FFDO is not something that other pilots know. It's a secret. They don't carry a gun in a holster or anything. They carry it in a secret luggage case. And other pilots do not know whether the person who's sitting by them is an FFDO. So there may be, as I said before, when this initial outburst was reported, it was dealt as a personnel issue. But when they realized...
But isn't it true that he wouldn't have even had that gun with him? Because he was going back on United as opposed to, I think it's United Express as opposed to Air Wisconsin? So I understand that there was a concern that he had a gun, but he probably or almost certainly didn't have the gun with him or wouldn't have been allowed to have the gun with him on this United flight.
And also because he was attending training, don't the regulations prohibit bringing a firearm to training?
Yes.
And so presumably he did not have a gun.
Well, here are the following undisputed facts that support that it was proper to have suspicion that he might have a gun. First, he's an FFDO who was authorized to carry a handgun aboard an aircraft. So he's an FFDO, he can carry a handgun. FFDOs carry their weapon in a briefcase or luggage. Other FFDOs previously brought their firearms to training sessions. FFDOs can bypass security with the firearm without logging it at DIA, the airport from which Mr. Hopper departed for the training. Air Wisconsin simply did not know whether he did or did not have firearm with him. This is a federally issued firearm. And if you look at actual TSA record, the email record, it says Mr. Doyle does not believe that he has the firearm with him at this time, but that they're still reporting a suspicion.
What email record is that?
The email, I believe I attached it to the answer brief. There's a email record, Mr. Joseph Dove from TSA, and it's redacted. And that says, redacted, does not believe that he has firearm at this time.
Mr. Young, all of the facts and circumstances that you cite, with the exception of the nature of the outburst, how he expressed his emotions, all the rest of them are circumstances together which could no way amount to suspicion. And I'm curious if you agree with that. In other words, any pilot with FDO status could be in that posture of failing and last chance and all of that.
Well, there,
and would not create suspicion whatsoever unless it was for the nature of the outburst. So the nature of the outburst seems to be the pivotal piece that would arguably turn this into a cause for a suspicion or be nothing whatsoever.
It's the nature of the outburst, the imminent termination, which he knew was going to occur. And as I mentioned, I think I mentioned before.
But what I'm saying to you is a pilot could be in a position where termination is imminent and where they've failed their testing and without the angry outburst would clearly not be reportable as engaged in suspicious behavior, suspicious of something further.
I think it's, I would agree with you that.
You would not concede that without the angry outburst, we have nothing here.
I think you have to consider all of it. I mean, you are.
I understand that. That's not the question.
I would not concede that because, as the United States stated in its amicus brief, Airlines has to report with imperfect information, and they must do it without much time. So you have to make real-time decisions at that time. And what I'm telling you is you have an angry outburst. You have an employee who is facing imminent termination. There were two other incidents that they discussed during this meeting before they called where a pilot who was facing imminent termination and who was terminated hijacked airplanes. And then you couple that with TSA policy. What did TSA say? When in doubt, report. We want to get all the suspicious information, and we will investigate.
Okay. Let me ask you a different question, which is, how is it that the pilot knew that termination was imminent?
He signed an agreement called the Last Chance Agreement, and this proficiency test that he had to pass. If he failed that test, it was over. So if you don't finish, you don't pass this training.
Wasn't the test about being qualified to fly a larger plane?
Yes. And he signed an agreement. This is the last chance. After he failed the three proficiency checks, he signed an agreement called the Last Chance Agreement. If he failed the fourth test, he was done. And when he walked out, obviously, with an angry outburst.
What I'm confused about is he was done in terms of the possibility of flying a larger plane, or he was done with his employment altogether?
Employment altogether.
Okay, I think I maybe missed that nuance somewhere.
He was being terminated, and he was, in fact, terminated the very next day.
Why would he be terminated for not passing a proficiency test to fly a different aircraft than he was flying?
I do not know the details of that, but I believe there was if he didn't fly, he wasn't able to fly a larger plane, there was no room for him. And he failed the 3 proficiency tests for it, and then he signed an agreement that said, if you don't pass the final one, your employment's
over. You will be terminated. Yes. That's what the agreement says.
Yes. Okay. That's why it was called last chance agreement.
Well, I thought the evidence showed that perhaps this simulation was set up for him to fail. And isn't a key part of his statement that he's going to go to legal? Isn't that a perfectly rational response, even though he was upset that he's going to go to the legal department to complain about a test that was set up so that he would fail? Isn't that what the jury got in the way of some evidence that it could consider?
Going back, that may be Mr. Hopper's perception of what occurred, but he also testified, there's no dispute he had an angry outburst.
The angry outburst is the profanity, right?
The profanity, and walked out in the middle of a session.
And that warrants a call to federal officials to have him taken off a plane and arrested?
You have to understand the when in doubt report is the...
Why couldn't they have just called the airline since they set up the flight that he was going to take? In fact, it was rescheduled, and say, would you just take a look and see whether he seems to be unstable and is carrying a gun?
Because of the TSA policy. The TSA policy was, we are federalizing this aviation security. We formed TSA to spearhead all aviation security matters. TSA does the investigation. We want the information, and we will do the investigation, is what TSA is saying.
Well, isn't it the nature of the way that the statement is made to TSA, though? Unstable person, carrying
exactly
a gun.
I would submit to you, if you consider the context, TSA says we want information about suspicious transactions. Suspicion by nature is you're not sure. You're basing it upon a hunch. So when you get that information, TSA, who asked for suspicion, I would submit, contrary to what the Court of Appeals said, we reported a suspicion.
Well, did Mr. Doyle talk with other superiors at Air Wisconsin to see whether he should make this report?
The superiors informed him to make the report. They did not tell him what words to use.
There's some concern about what he actually said. I guess TSA didn't record the conversation, because we're working off Doyle's notes, which got altered then a little bit later, or changed at least.
Yes, TSA takes position that most of the security directives and everything is national security, and they will not reveal the information. So we have to walk around it. But
so they have that information, but they wouldn't give it to us?
Exactly. No, we got the email record of what was conveyed and Mr. Doyle's notes. And I am assuming, for the sake of this argument, that he made those arguments because the jury found that the statements are defamatory. But even with those statements that he made, I would submit to you, we were reporting a suspicion of threat. And the listener took it as a suspicion of threat because they asked the airlines to provide suspicions, not an actual threat, so that they can do their own investigation. And TSA was the one who removed them. We provided the information so that they could deal with the situation. And they chose that route, not Air Wisconsin. Air Wisconsin was required by federal law to report suspicion. And, you know, I would submit to you, if, I'll just give an example. If I were to start shouting and using profanities during this argument, you might question my mental stability. And if I start to shout as Mr. Hopper did and slam my paper and say, you win, that's it, this is a bunch of shit, I freaking quit, you're railroading this situation, stormed out of the argument, you might say, He's unstable. He's mentally unstable.
You might also say, I'm going to get you.
Well, I got some more example. And if you knew that I was going to be disbarred, you might be a little bit more concerned about my mental stability. And if you found out that I have a concealed weapons permit, and even had an inkling, just an inkling, you don't know if I have one, a gun or not, but if just an inkling, hunch, that I might have a gun on school grounds, you might report me to the authorities. And your report, as in this case, should be considered a report of suspicion, not a verifiable fact. And it certainly doesn't justify, in this case, a defamation award of $1.4 million. And that's my example of, and I think that's the problem with the Court of Appeals. They considered it as reporting actual threat. We reported a suspicion so that TSA can conduct its own investigation.
Thank you, Mr. Yeung.
Your Honors, my name is Scott McGaff, and I speak for Mr. Hopper, who is seated in the first row here. This case is about Patrick Doyle's knowingly false, reckless defamatory call to TSA, the harm that it caused Bill Hopper, and the facts which would support the jury's conclusion that Mr. Doyle acted with actual malice within the meaning of New York Times versus Sullivan, if the court believes that that's the standard which should be applied here.
Counsel, I'm over here.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Judge Mark, I step out.
I know I can be ignored.
Well, that's not my intent.
I hate to derail you, but I wonder if you could respond to counsel's final statement that the notion that what was conveyed was not a threat, but a suspicion of a threat, and that under these contexts, when you're left with sort of imperfect information, shouldn't officials be at least protected in some way, that there's an obligation to make sure that security is paramount. And if you have some inkling that perhaps something could happen, you have an obligation to convey that suspicion.
Your Honor, I can answer that question directly by referring you to the Airline Transportation Security Act, or ATSA. ATSA allows a qualified immunity for the report of a suspicious transaction. ATSA does not, however, protect knowingly false statements or statements made with reckless disregard. So the answer is yes, there is protection, but not based on inklings. We've got to be doing something more than that. Otherwise, ATSA means nothing. As the court is aware, this was a highly contested, factually intensive dispute during a three-week jury trial.
Well, what evidence is there that Mr. Doyle had an actual animus towards this person?
Well, first of all, there's evidence that Air Wisconsin and its employees who were close to Mr. Doyle had actual animus. But there is also evidence from which the record reveals that Mr. Doyle had actual animus. And you only have to look to the notes that he concocted following the day of the call. Beginning on December 9th, Mr. Doyle fabricated evidence about an event which took place in October, which never occurred. He was closely related to Mr. Christensen, and as the trial court noted, there was evidence of a conspiracy of hatred in which Mr. Doyle was a participant. But those notes are quite telling. The notes refer back to an event 2 months earlier on October 14th. Mr. Doyle claims that Mr. Hopper acted in such a way that Mr. Doyle feared for his own safety. Mr. Doyle cut the exam or the debriefing early and failed to fill federal paperwork out required during the testing because of his fear. That wasn't enough for Mr. Doyle. He later altered those notes and claimed that Mr. Hopper's activities on October 14, 2004 were such that everybody in the simulator building's safety was at risk. Obviously, the jury completely disregarded that testimony. What actually happened is somebody on the panel pointed out earlier was that that evening, Mr. Doyle and Mr. Hopper had drinks together. The evidence was replete with the information about what would have happened had Mr. Doyle been telling the truth.
Counsel, let me...
Hello, down here. If I can stop you there, though, I guess I'm wondering, is there... You're putting all this together, but do we have any direct evidence that Mr. Doyle ever said, I'm out to get your client?
No, he never admitted that. But in an actual malice case, the jury is entitled to, as is the trial court, rely on circumstantial evidence of Mr. Doyle's actual malice.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, what would you conclude from that circumstantial evidence?
I would conclude that Mr. Doyle actually had an evil intent. There was also evidence from which Mr. Hopper, pardon the expression, was correct when he stated that the training up to that point had been a bunch of shit, and that Air Wisconsin employees were actually out to get him during the training session. In fact, there was an admission by Mr. Doyle that certain employees should not have even been involved in Mr. Hopper's training because of the immense power a training simulator operator has over a training pilot. There's evidence in the record from airline aviation experts who said that if it's the desire, a training simulator operator can fail any pilot, and the pilot won't know what happened. Here, there's evidence that two of the people who testified in this case, Mark Sherman and Todd Hanneman, had that type of bias. Mr. Hanneman said, we should have fired that guy when we had the chance. Mr. Doyle admitted that if Mr. Hanneman said those words, he should have never been involved in Mr. Hopper's training on the earlier sessions. There's also evidence that Mr. Sherman, who was a critical witness in this case, said that that asshole finally got his when the call came in. So there is... Yes.
I think we got the point about the animus.
Okay. I think it's fairly clear from this record, Your Honor, that it existed.
I understand it's disputed, but anyway. But I guess I'd like you to focus on the facts dealing with the falsity or truth or falsity of the reckless disregard for the facts of the report.
All right.
What? We got the animus point.
I gotcha. Are you asking me whether that's protected opinion? Or whether there were...
No, I'm not asking for this.
All right.
I want to know what the facts are in terms of the de novo review of the New York Times.
All right. First of all, let's talk about the standard for de novo review briefly, and then I'll get to those facts.
I'd rather you talk about the facts.
Okay.
Quite candidly, as far as I'm concerned, I don't find your argument very convincing about the standard. So.
Okay.
So I'm interested in the Constitution.
All right. The facts that support clear and convincing evidence have to do with, first of all, the statements were determined to be false.
Well, what indicates that it was made deliberately with a reckless disregard of the truth, or falsehood?
Let's turn to statement number one. All right, and statement number one was... And I'm quoting from Mr. Doyle's own words, was an FFDO who may be armed. He was traveling from I-80 Denver later that day, and we were concerned about his mental stability and whereabouts of his firearm.
Okay. What evidence at that time was known to be false, reckless disregard of that statement?
First of all, the factual connotation from that statement is that Mr. Hopper was a threat to this aircraft. When the factual connotation is capable of being proven true or false, the statement is actual.
Wait one second. That's a possible connotation. It's not a necessary one, is it?
But it was supported by the facts on this record, Your Honor. In this particular case, Mr. Doyle knew that was the connotation that would come from this statement. Mr. Orozco testified that if those words were actually said, and the jury found that they were, that would give TSA the impression of a very bad situation on board that aircraft. And Mr. LaWare, who was the highest-ranking official testifying on behalf of Air Wisconsin in this case, testified that would give an impression of a threat to the aircraft. So it is not only a factual connotation, it was the factual connotation. And
I have trouble understanding that. Maybe I can understand that better if the reported information was that he was armed and more definitive, but it seems all qualified. He may be armed, which seems to imply that that could go either direction, et cetera. I mean, none of the information seems firm. It seems to suggest possibilities.
Well, we have to look at the entirety of the statements in their context. And may be armed, by definition, under certain circumstances, an FFDO may always be armed. Here, however, when an airline says he's an FFDO and may be armed, and we are concerned about the whereabouts of his weapon, that implies that they have information suggesting that he actually has the weapon, contrary to FFDO protocol.
Again, I have a little trouble with that. Why doesn't that imply we don't know where his weapon is?
Because it would be meaningless in the context of the mental stability comment. So, and under Milkovich's, and under Virginia law, simply making a statement with a qualifier maybe, or in my opinion, is not enough to protect the statement as an opinion as opposed to a statement of fact.
I think we understand the legal principles. We're after the facts.
All right. The second aspect of the statement, we are concerned about his mental stability. We know that that was provably false and was false on two levels. First, when somebody says we have concerns, the concerns actually have to exist. The evidence in this case was that no one had concerns about Mr. Hopper's mental stability. That statement is actionable. Professor Sachs, or Judge Sachs now, tells us in Sachs on Defamation that when you make a statement like that, the fact is whether the concerns existed. Here, the undisputed evidence introduced at trial in this case was there were four people present in this meeting. Number one was Mr. Doyle, and I'll get to that in a minute. Mr. Doyle did not actually have concerns about Mr. Hopper's mental stability and testified that if he had said that in the context of a weapon, he would have caused Mr. Hopper undue harm, admitted that under oath, as opposed to due harm. Obviously, if he had the concerns and he was concerned about the weapon and he made the comment, any harm to Mr. Hopper would be due. The second individual who testified at this trial was Mr. Roscoe, through his deposition, who said, I didn't have those concerns, and I wish he didn't say those words. That was also true with Mr. LaWare's testimony. Kevin LaWare, again, the vice president of Air Wisconsin, also testified that he had no concerns about Hopper's mental stability. Finally, Bob Frisch, who's an FFDO, testified that he did not have concerns about Hopper's mental stability. That raises one other point. Air Wisconsin absolutely knew in this meeting that Mr. Hopper was an FFDO. In fact, they knew before the meeting. Mr. Yun said in his remarks that that was recent information learned late in the day. It was not recent information learned. Mr. Doyle knew at the time the call came in from Mark Sherman that Mr. Hopper was an FFDO. Bob Frisch, who participated in the meeting and was involved in this, absolutely knew Mr. Hopper was an FFDO and was an FFDO himself. So this wasn't recently sprung on Air Wisconsin. And that gets us to the actual malice question again, Justice Bender. The case is cited for a mere failure to investigate.
Before you move on, could I have you address the third piece, which was about termination?
Well, that was absolutely false.
Well, is it not true that Mr. Hopper knew that if he failed this final training, that was it?
He believed that his termination was likely to occur, certainly. But if you're talking about the doctrine of substantial truth, the test under Masson and Virginia law following Masson is that you take the statement in its entirety, you look at the pleaded truth, and then you look at what the pleaded truth would do in changing the position of the hearer of the statement. Here, if we look at the pleaded truth under Masson, the pleaded truth would be Mr. Hopper was not unstable, Mr. Hopper had no weapon, and Mr. Hopper had not been terminated today. So taking all of those statements as true, which is how you determine substantial truth, if that call had been made to TSA, obviously the reaction would have been different. we would not have been met with a hijack in progress response. In fact, TSA would have said, why are you bothering us? The third fact that can bear on an actual malice inquiry here under the constitutional case law and Virginia law is whether or not the statement was made with evil intent. Evil intent without more does not give rise to actual malice. That's clear. Evil intent is a factor, however, and can be considered by the jury in its actual malice determination. Here, the record was replete with evidence of Air Wisconsin and Doyle's evil intent to harm Mr. Hopper through his knowingly false statement. There's one other incident which I wanted to bring to your attention, which is not set forth in the brief, but there was also a sham grievance hearing held by Air Wisconsin after the fact. When you read Kevin LaWare's testimony, and if you'll just bear with me for a second.
Was this evidence presented to the jury?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the trial transcript. It wasn't mentioned in the brief, but I think it's something that you should consider. When and if you conducted a de novo review, you'll see it in, oh, here it is. It's transcript pages 2544-2553, and Mr. LaWare is confronted with evidence of an email about just conducting a grievance so that we can curry favor in the arbitration. Obviously, Mr. LaWare admitted that that's not how we do things at Air Wisconsin, and that caused him great concern. So the record is replete with evidence of an evil intent on the behalf of both Doyle and others. Additional evidence of the evil intent is Doyle's lying in the arbitration. The panel is correct. On October 14th, Mr. Doyle actually had dinner or drinks with Mr. Hopper following this alleged event that Mr. Doyle fabricated. Then when confronted with this in the arbitration about what happened, he talked about a different series of events, then testified that he wanted to correct his false testimony, but his lawyer wouldn't let him. And Air Wisconsin said, that absolutely is not how we do things. The other thing is that the evidence of the cover-up is evidence of culpability. Doyle's fabrication of the events of October 14th, followed by his attempts to elicit not only one, but two additional people in his cover-up. One was Mark Sherman, and Mr. Doyle asked Mr. Sherman to concoct notes about Mr. Hopper's stability, which were revealed, excuse me, that was Todd Hanneman, I apologize. There were a couple of bad actors here. Hanneman was asked to concoct notes that would support Doyle's comments about stability, which Doyle incidentally denied he said. And the cross-examination of Mr. Hanneman later revealed that the notes were false. He also asked Mr. Scharf, who was the co-pilot involved in the training, about Hopper's demeanor during and after this event. Mr. Scharf, who Mr. Doyle, incredibly in light of what he said about his belief of Hopper being a threat with a weapon, in addition to booking Mr. Hopper twice on United flights, asked Mr. Scharf to drive Mr. Hopper to the airport. And Mr. Scharf responded to inquiries from Mr. Doyle indicating that he didn't believe that Mr. Hopper was a threat to anybody, but he understood why Mark Sherman might have believed that to be the case. The problem with this was, it was Doyle that told Scharf that Sherman believed that was the case, because Sherman, who was in the simulator, testified that he had no reason to believe that Hopper was a threat, never believed him to be a threat, and that Hopper was perfectly safe to get on an aircraft. So what this indicates is that Mr. Doyle actually suggested to Mr. Scharf that Mr. Sherman felt threatened, contrary to Mr. Sherman's sworn testimony. Finally, I want to get to Mr. Doyle's own testimony. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mr.
Gav, can you just clear up something?
Sure.
Doyle made a telephone call to TSA, right?
Right.
And that specific telephone call and the notes made by TSA are confidential. So all this stuff is recreated. Is that right?
No.
Okay. I just need a little fact.
Sure. Doyle made a telephone call to TSA. What actually took place between TSA and Doyle, we don't know. What was produced was some emails from TSA pursuant to multiple FOIA requests. Initially, when Mr. Doyle testified in his deposition...
Wait.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Just kind of give me the facts. I understand your position and the importance of the case. I'm not trying to denigrate you in any way.
I appreciate that.
Help me out.
Sure.
So the actual phone call, whatever notes were made by TSA are not... We don't have them. They're not part of the record.
That's right. We do not have those.
Okay. But we have a couple of emails from TSA.
We do have a couple of emails from TSA.
And you got them, but what's their connection in terms of the phone call?
Air Wisconsin has asked that those be considered to demonstrate that...
What's the factual connection? Never mind.
Okay. They were made sometime during the process of TSA's response.
This is before he was arrested?
That's correct. Well, actually, they recount what happened. Their appendix is to both Air Wisconsin's opening brief.
I understand that, but okay. I don't understand the sequence.
Okay.
It's confusing.
Finally, I want to turn back to your original question, Your Honor, because we're looking at the evidence of actual malice. And the record is replete with evidence of actual malice.
Well, counsel, before you turn back to actual malice, can I just follow up with your answers to Chief Justice Bender? I mean, we don't actually know what Doyle said to the TSA.
But the jury was entitled to conclude that Mr. Doyle said what was in his own notes. And so Doyle has a contemporaneous writing written within 24 hours of what he said. And then he tried to deny he said the contents of his own notes. But the evidence, which we did get from TSA, suggests that Doyle did make the comments that are in his own notes. That's how this all fits in. Okay. And then let's look at what Mr. Doyle said, which would support a finding of knowing falsity. I'm reading from the transcript, page 814 to page 818. Question, and this is referring to the notes that we've been talking about, Justice Ide. Mr. Doyle, if you would please turn to Exhibit 11, the second page, which were some of the notes. Sometime shortly before 4 o'clock, you called TSA, and you notified them that you had a disgruntled company employee, an FFDO who may be armed, who was traveling from IAD Denver later that day, and we were concerned about the whereabouts of his firearm and his mental stability at the time. Isn't that what you told them? Answer, that is not what I told TSA. I told TSA everything up until the final statement there about his mental stability at the time. These are my own notes that I used for Captain Orozco so that we could build a timeline on everything that occurred with Mr. Hopper. Remarkably, Mr. Doyle was denying the words that he used, even though they're in his own notes. Then he went on page 816. And your testimony now is that you didn't say anything about Mr. Hopper's stability or mental stability, correct? Not to TSA, that is correct. Question, and in fact, you knew if you would have actually said those words that you would have caused Mr. Hopper the potential for undue harm, correct? That's correct. Question. And I was reading from a quote at this point in time, but this is the question. I did not talk to him about his mental stability because I can't be a judge of his mental stability. I've talked about that before. That's what you told the jury, right? That's what I told you in the deposition, yes. And you've told the jury that you didn't make any comments about his stability, right? That's correct. Mr. Doyle knew exactly what went on in that meeting. He knew that no one had concerns about mental stability. He used the words anyway. The notes from TSA confirm that he used the words. Mr. Doyle knew that his words were defamatory and would cause Mr. Hopper undue harm. He denied saying the words. The jury, as the fact finder in this case, and we have to give deference to their factual decisions, determined that Mr. Doyle, in fact, used the words. That's part and parcel of the list, Your Honor. I want to turn real briefly to issue number one upon which you granted cert, which was whether ATSA requires a determination of early qualified immunity. And that issue is well dealt with in our brief. But what?
Let me ask you a question about that.
Sure.
If we assume, if we buy your argument on actual malice, as the Court of Appeals did, or at least part of it, what happens? How do we handle the qualified immunity issue?
Well, what you do, first of all, becomes moot, because the qualified immunity statute, which, by the way, Air Wisconsin argues incorporates New York Times actual malice, but the clear words of it indicate it does not. And I want to point out one aspect of that, Justice Bender.
Oh, how about answering my questions? Yeah.
I thought I just did.
Okay. In other words, just moot?
It's moot.
Okay. Thanks.
And that's because it went to the jury. The judge didn't decide that it shouldn't go to the jury.
That's right.
Let it go to the jury. So then the jury, in its verdict, basically takes care of the issue.
It basically takes care of the
qualified
issue.
Qualified immunity doesn't apply because why?
Because the jury found punitive damages, which is based on the New York Times actual malice standard. And a really good case on that is the government micro case versus Jackson. Also, the United States, in a footnote to its brief, admitted that that's the case. Curiously, that footnote disappears when they write the amicus brief up here. But I want to just take one little point on the ATSA qualified immunity issue. ATSA does not incorporate New York Times versus Sullivan actual malice. And the reason that that Air Wisconsin wants to argue that it does is so that we have the heightened position on actual malice, regardless of the arguments that we've made that actual malice is not the standard review in a non-constitutional definition.
And now the reason for that is that the statute specifies a certain standard, right?
And the statute specifies a certain standard, which is lower than actual malice. And we know it's lower than actual malice because, first of all, if it had been intended to incorporate actual malice, the legislature knew how to do that.
Because that's a well-understood doctrine at the time they wrote this legislation.
Absolutely. But furthermore, Justice Hobbs, if you look at Exception 1, Exception 1 is a lower standard than knowing falsity. Exception 1 makes it clear that you can lose immunity under ATSA for the publication of knowingly false, inaccurate, or misleading information, not just knowingly false. So if you publish it knowing that it's misleading, which is well below the New York Times actual malice standard, you lose the immunity. Your Honor, I think I'm done with my argument, but I would field any questions.
I'd like to have your reaction to what the United States brief does or doesn't do. They asked us to be very careful about something. What is that, and do you agree with that?
Yeah, they asked us to be very careful to make sure that the record sustains the requisite evidence of actual malice before affirming this judgment.
So are they backing away from what the statute actually says?
No, they're not backing away from what the statute actually says. They're just saying, they are saying if you go down the defamation route, then you have to be have clear and convincing evidence of actual malice. But they are backing away from, or they're trying to incorporate the actual malice standard of New York Times versus Sullivan without actually saying it.
I was just confused.
Yeah, I was confused too when I read it. So, but I think that's what they're arguing.
Okay.
Counsel, if I might just ask a quick follow-up question. The Court of Appeals focused on the reckless disregard prong, if you will, of the immunity
right.
provision. And yet you talk about how the first provision talks about actual knowledge that the disclosure was false, inaccurate, or misleading. Are you relying on that first?
No, I'm saying that you could determine, and I think the Court of Appeals went easy on Mr. Doyle, because there's actually evidence from which you could determine that this statement was knowingly false. And if you break each of the components of the statement, you can determine that each of those components or the implications from those components is knowingly false. But there's clear evidence of reckless disregard here. And one other factor that I didn't add that I think is important because it's not mentioned in our brief that would go into this, is in the Snup case, which is cited in our supplemental authority. The fact that the jury found punitive damages is also an indication of actual malice. The jury was willing to punish Air Wisconsin for what it did, and Snup makes it clear that under Virginia law, that's a factor. And I think that's also implicit in all of the Colorado cases and the U.S. Supreme Court cases dealing with this issue.
And I have a different question about the immunity process and whether that question should be submitted to a judge or a jury. We're interpreting federal law here, a federal provision. Does it make sense that how that gets implemented should vary from state to state depending on state law? I mean, in this case, the Court of Appeals relied on Colorado law to say that, in fact, this question should be submitted to a jury. But under different state law, the directive might be that that should go to a judge.
Well,
there be inconsistency? I'm just concerned, if we're interpreting right. federal law, is it appropriate that there be inconsistency across the states?
You won't reach inconsistency across the states, Your Honor, because what Air Wisconsin actually asked you to do was determine whether or not there existed a suspicious transaction to invoke immunity in the first place. Here, so whatever gives rise to qualified immunity, and they encourage you to follow Section 1983 standards. But as you know, those standards deal with whether or not there's a clearly articulable standard by which a federal agency or, excuse me, a state actor knows that his conduct violates clearly established constitutional rights. Here, there's no state actor, number one. Number two, there is already a clearly defined standard. You can't do these things subject to exception. And number three, on the issue of suspicious transaction, that issue, even if it were a mistake by the court, Air Wisconsin is not arguing that the exceptions require legal interpretation. They're arguing only that there be sufficient evidence in the record to allow that to go to a jury on the existence of the exceptions. Here, because the jury found that there was such sufficient evidence, under the any mistake made there is harmless.
Thank you very much for your argument. I want to thank both attorneys for their argument. The case will be submitted on the briefs. Justice Coates will participate in the decision. I would request that both lawyers spend a little time answering questions of the students.